Hello and welcome to Backchat. Hello to everyone in Bristol, to listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, and the Q Radio in Hertfordshire, and to our listeners in Swindon. Hello Swindon FM, and hello to our new listeners in Cirencester in the Cotswolds. I'm James Melia.
And I'm Poppy Searchfield.
And I'm Kirsty Paul. Coming up in the show.
A line on the ground which marks the hull. The actual hull markings, where it was actually built, so people can get an idea of scale. Also, they can look out from the windows here, and they can look down and get an idea as well of the outline of the hull, and it goes right all the way down to the water's edge. And at night time, that will light up blue as well, especially for any guests who are here for hospitality, because we double as a function facility as well.
A visit to the Titanic exhibition in Belfast.
And it examines ecological disruption and personal loss. Issues like that, and the film explores maternal ambivalence and trauma and loss, and that's ecologically mirrored through visual representations of earthquakes and floods and nature. The film explores ways in which the poetry and the text work together to enhance each other and to bring more narratives to the front so that you can read it in various different ways, a diversity of narratives.
Two filmmakers are here in the studio to talk about their poetry film.
Our first guest is reputably the world expert on sedan chairs and is the proud owner of some of them. So let's hear about this fascinating form of transport that spanned over a long period in our history. So we have Stephen Loft-Simpson with us, who is a specialist in sedan chairs. So for some of us who may not be quite as knowledgeable as your good self, would you explain what a sedan chair is to start off with?
Well, there are several definitions. I tend to use the tight definition, which is also known as a glass chair. When they were first thought of, they were just like armchairs with poles. They are really called carrying chairs, although if you look up the internet, you'll find carrying chairs labelled as sedan chairs. Then people built sides to them, and they became canopied chairs, where you had a cover over the top in case it rained or for the sun. Then people added sides to them, and they became enclosed chairs. And then someone in the City of London added glass windows, and they were called sedans. They weren't called chairs. They were called sedans. And they could either be with a chair inside or as a litter. And this was at the time of just after the death of Shakespeare. And they first appeared on stage in 1634, from memory.
1634, my goodness.
Beginning of 1635 in the Salisbury Court Theatre, which was just north of the Thames in Globe. But the creation of this, the sedan and the chair, they only became joined in about 1708. So if you do a search on, for instance, the British Library newspapers, and you type in sedan chair and you wonder why there's nothing before 1708, it's because no one called them sedan chairs. But if you type in the word sedan, you go back, and the earliest mention, I think, is about 1643 in Paris, where the gentleman attending the council meeting travelled by his chair because the crowd was a bit displeased with what the council was discussing and going to vote on. So he thought it would be safer, and they threw, presumably, various missiles, tomatoes and eggs and so on, and they broke the glass in the sedan chair, which is why we know sedan chairs have glass.
So the purpose of a sedan chair, is this a means of travel if you can't get your horse and cart down to an area? I mean, I would assume you can only be carried if you have servants that are willing to do that for you.
Well, there are two sorts, really, of sedan chair. There was the public hire chair, of which, for instance, in Bristol, there was one in Queen's Square, and there was one up on the Council College Green in 1757. So when they first started, they started predominantly as taxis, today, and the minimum fare would be equivalent of probably £5. But the important thing people don't realise about sedan chairs is they were really indoor to indoor transport. So you were picked up and you did not have to wear your outdoor footwear. You could wear your silk slippers or whatever. Go and attend the opera, go and attend a Handel concert. The real development came with entertainment. Obviously, some people went to places like Vauxhall Gardens and so on. Before that, it was really for the wealthy, and it was for people who wore long clothes. So, for instance, for the men, it would be typically people who were clerics and with the church who wore gowns, or lawyers. And then, of course, there would be witnesses, etc., attending court. Otherwise, it was predominantly women's transport, and in fact 70% of the surviving sedan chairs, 70% of roughly the invoices, are women's, and predominantly the ones which survive are marriage gifts.
Very interesting. When we see period pieces, we don't necessarily see sedan chairs, we see horses and carts and that kind of thing, but I take it they were well used.
Yeah, there were a lot of them. I try and work out how many there were in Britain, and I think at their peak of their use, which was probably between 1770 and about 1790s, there were, I've estimated, 6,000. There were 2,000 public hire chairs, taxis, and from looking at the various records and so on, there must have been twice that number. So it was 6,000. And in fact, places like France have a great deal more, because in England, the owners tended to, the second owner tended to remove the personal detail, which generally just was some initials or so on. But in France, they were often painted, and then they had the coat of arms, and they were personal things. So if the mother died, their daughter would tend to inherit it and hold on to it, and then their granddaughter. And that's partly why so many survive in France, apart from the fact that there's more that survive from the southern part, where the weather's warmer and less wet.
So the sedan, which is obviously the correct way of referring to it, it would be lifted by two servants, men, who, you know, depending on whether it was a taxi, is that correct?
Yes. Well, there were virtually always men. There were never two women. Occasionally, if a man couldn't be found, someone's wife was drawn in to carry the rear half. But normally, if you were short of someone, you went to the pub and you asked for what was called an odd man to carry the back of the chair, and the owner would carry the front. So there are drawings with asking for odd men and so on. Otherwise, if you look at places like in London, one of the reasons you had a sedan chair is if someone came round quickly and said so-and-so was ill, and why not go and visit your friend? They might not survive till tomorrow. What happened in London was there were an awful lot of coaches, but they weren't always kept at the owner's residence, and the horses were often kept in stables. And you had to go and order them in advance. So it was fine if you were attending someone's wedding or funeral. You knew which day it was going to be. But if you were called in to go and visit someone in the middle of the night, it was very much a case of getting everyone together. But the other reason, I think, the majority of chairs in London were public hire up until probably about the 1730s. And after the 1730s, it widens much beyond the court and a few individuals. So, for instance, Sir Isaac Newton had a chair, and he used to travel up to the Tower of London, where he was Warden of the Mint. His chair was found, for instance, in his attic when he died in 1727. So some men, important men, would have a chair. Women, also, if you were going out in your jewellery and finery, apart from not wishing to get wet or your hairdo blown about, also it protected you from the footpads who might steal your jewellery, whip your handbag, all those sorts of things. So it had a practicality. And on the larger houses, of course, you could be carried upstairs. So some people would be carried from one house to the bedside of the person who was ill, so they could have a conversation up there, because, you know, there could be two women who were both in their 80s, very rare, or 70s. But with regard to who actually carried them, obviously the best nobles would have their own servants. and would allocate them. But the question is, not fully aware, that the royal family had, for instance, the Queen had six sedan chair carriers. Although, interestingly, a lot earlier on, if you go back to Charles II's time, they are not called chairmen. They're referred to as littermen, and they obviously didn't pick up waste paper around the palaces. They actually carried what was called the litter.
So what brought you to be so fascinated by sedan chairs? Was one passed down through your family at all?
Not at all, no. It's the connection came in three ways, really. The continuation on my research on sedan chairs was inspired by my godmother, who used to go to school in what they called was a sedan chair in Hong Kong, although the English correct definition, of course, would be called a canopied carrying chair. She lived on the peak, and the rickshaws, of course, were only down on the level. And if you went up the funicular railway, there was a sedan chair stand at the top. So, age of eight, she sometimes, rather than walk to school, used her pocket money to get on. So she's nearly 91. She's the only person I've ever met who's actually paid money to travel around in a chair. Although there could be others, obviously, in Hong Kong, because they didn't discontinue them, I think, until about just after the Second World War.
The Glass Chair by Martin Reeser. A palanquin for Mrs. Quinn, whose dainty feet should never meet the foul ordure that lines the street. Send for the linkman, send for the chairman, stout fellows in gold livery, to carry her to Aunt Maud. From her boudoir she steps aboard. There's not a breath to tousle hair. Her comfort is to sit the chair and wave benignly at the crowds. Beware the linkmen clipping on mid wavering lights and shouts. Never a stumble to the door, up the stairs into the house, steps in velvet to the floor. Is Maud waking? Not at all. The poor soul is at peace. She died while waiting for her niece.
Thanks there to Stephen Loft-Simpson, world expert on sedan chairs, and to Martin reading his poem. Our next feature is a trip to the Titanic exhibition in Belfast, probably one of the most exciting and interesting museums created this century. You may think that there is not much to see, considering the ship lies on the ocean bed off Halifax, Nova Scotia, but you will be amazed at how far this exhibition recreates one of the greatest liners ever built. There is an audiovisual which takes you down to the wreck itself, so you can see the artefacts lying on the ocean floor miles under the sea. So let's play now one of the songs from the epic film Titanic. This is called The Sinking of the Titanic. Thank you.
and I'm here with one of the guides. Tell us where we are now.
You've just come through Boomtown Belfast, so we try to put it into context. We tell you about the industrial heritage of Belfast around about 100 years ago when the Olympic class of ships were being built. And we have a mock-up of the drawing office, and we've just come through the drawing office, learnt about how the ship was designed. And we've just come around the corner now, and we have a mock-up to scale of one of the legs of the huge Aral gantry. And that was a huge structure that was built by the Aral Company, Sir William Aral of Glasgow, and they were bridge builders. And they built many bridges, including the Forth Rail Bridge, Tay Bridge, and London's Tower Bridge. And they were subcontracted by Harland and Wolff, the builders of the Olympic class, which included Titanic. And they were subcontracted to come over here to Belfast and actually construct the huge gantry. But it was designed here in Belfast by Harland and Wolff, specifically for the building of the Olympic class. At that stage, the world's largest ships. So this is what we're standing underneath at the minute. It's about 65 feet high. And the idea is that round the corner from this replica, there are lifts. They're in the design of the original cage lifts, and they will take guests right up to the top of the gantry, where there's a mock-up of how the gantry looked, and there's also photographs of the gantry full scale. You get an idea of what it looked like even under construction, and we have a videos as well and photographs of the Aral gantry at the top here as well. So it's just to give guests an idea of scale. This was a massive feat of engineering, the building of the gantry. There would have been 33 of these massive legs in three rows of 11 outside where the building is today. And the site of the slipways, there's a lot of interpretation out there as well. The legs of the gantry are marked by huge metal ground posts that actually mark where the legs would have been, just to give people an idea of the scale of the structure. And there's interpretive panels out on the site of the slipways that people can read for themselves as you walk down the original site of the slipways.
Do we have any idea of the scale at this point of the Titanic? How long was it?
Well, the Titanic was 882 feet and 9 inches long. When there are photographs, obviously, of it under construction, a great idea of scale is if people go out onto the site of the slipways, there's actually a line on the ground which marks the actual hull markings where it was actually built, so people can get an idea of scale. Also, they can look out from the windows here and they can look down and get an idea as well of the outline of the hull, and it goes right all the way down to the water's edge. And at night time, that will light up blue as well, especially for any guests who are here for hospitality, because we double as a function facility as well.
Have they worked out what caused the demise of the Titanic yet?
I might sound a bit glib here, but unfortunately it was navigated into an iceberg, which was basically caused five of the watertight bulkheads to fracture, causing the ship to sink. So we do get people who, and people have all sorts of ideas and conspiracy theories and all sorts of things, but unfortunately it just boils down to the fact that it glided along, or glanced along, a spur of an iceberg, which punctured five of the watertight bulkheads, which sadly caused it to sink eventually.
And they had no radar?
No radars back then. The Marconi radio was just really coming into its own, and it was used obviously to communicate with other vessels, which included Carpathia, which in fact did rescue just over 700 of the passengers. But no radar, unfortunately. Your next port of call is up to the top of the gantry, and then you go around to the shipyard ride, where there's interpretive information, audiovisual information. You learn about the build processes, about the riveting, the plating, how the actual build took place. So it's very interesting. It takes about 6 minutes.
Where are we going now? Take your seat now and fly through the busy shipyard, experiencing all the sights, smells and sounds. So we're actually going on to a little tramway, electric tramway with seats. The sound effects of the shipyard in the background.
There's no roller coaster in this, is it?
Sorry?
There's no roller coaster in this.
No, it's very slow. It just takes you through the shipyard and tells you all about Titanic being built. Nice and slow, it's not like a roller coaster.
That's okay.
You'll enjoy it.
So can you just tell us what we're going to experience?
It's a big cable car ride. It's going to take you through the shipyard, tell you all about Titanic being built. You're going to see all the sights and smell, all the different smells of the shipyard. It's a great experience. So whenever you're ready, you can go on to the shipyard ride, okay?
Welcome to the Harland & Wolff Shipyard in Belfast. We're about to drop down into the Arrow Gantry, a 6,000-ton structure over 200 foot high. The gantry has been constructed to house three massive ships being built for the White Star Line.
It's quite amazing. We're suspended.
The ship you can see being built is
yard
number 401, which will soon be known as RMS Titanic, the largest passenger liner in the world. Titanic's construction begins with a series of pitch pine blocks laid on the slipway. These are stacked about 4 feet high with angled wedges on top. On these are laid the first steel plates which form the ship's hull and the vertical keel. Now we're travelling along the hull on your right towards the bow. Here you can see the steel ribs or frames that make up the skeleton of the ship. These are curved to give the hull its shape and positioned between 2 and 3 feet apart. Lowering them into place is a dangerous process until they've been firmly joined up by the horizontal girders called stringers, which lock them in position. Then the shell plates that make up the hull are riveted onto the outside.
We're actually going down into the forge now.
The ship's frames start out as straight bars. These are heated in a furnace, then hooked out onto slabs of cast iron, where they're hammered into shape against an iron mould.
There's audio-visual film at the back of the forge to show us exactly what all the bits are useful. We're swinging round in this
Titanic's plates
car.
Are laid onto the hull in two ways. At the sides, the shell plates are alternately sunken and raised, while at the bottom of the hull, they are fastened using the clinker method with overlapping plates. A rivet squad consists of 3 men and 2 boys. On one side of the plate, the heater boy heats the iron rivets on a portable hearth. Using tongs, he throws the rivet to the catch boy, who places it in the hole for the holder up, who holds the rivet head in place with the head of a holding up hand. Every plate had to be riveted in place, which was partially mechanised and partially done by hand by riveting squads.
There's a huge amount of rivets here.
On the other side of the plate, 2 men work with smaller riveting hammers to fit the rivet tightly into a pre-punched hole, striking it in rapid succession. For the teams in the double bottom, the work of riveting can be very hard. The only light comes from candles. Stray pieces of hot metal often fly around, so riveters have to wear a muffler to protect their necks. See the steel decks being riveted in place. These are not intended to strengthen the ship, but they are rigid enough to resist the force of the hull being hit by high seas. They also arch slightly upwards, so that water falling onto them will drain overboard. At the stern of the ship, we pass over the massive castings that will support Titanic's rudder. These frames have to be enormously strong to withstand the force of the rudder turning in heavy seas. Nearly launch day. Titanic's enormous weight will soon be transferred from the supporting blocks to the launchways that will slide with the ship into the sea. The launchways have been greased with 1 inch of tallow and oil. Workmen will shortly risk serious injury by knocking away vertical wooden props under compression beneath the hull. At the moment of launch, the sliding ways will be released by hydraulic rams. It's the evening of the 30th of May, 1911. Tomorrow, Harland & Wolff will launch Titanic, the heaviest object ever moved by man. Up to 100,000 people will gather on the banks of the River Lagan to watch. The Arrow Gantry has been decked out with signal flags spelling good luck. And tonight, the whole city is celebrating the pride of Belfast.
So,
Thank you for joining us here today at Harland & Wolff, builder of the world's most elegant ships for the White Star Line. The tour will end in a few seconds. We look forward to seeing you again.
I'm here in the foyer of the Titanic exhibition in Belfast.
My name's Julie Bryan, and I'm one of the visitor experience staff here at Titanic.
And it was a year this March since it first opened.
That's right, it opened on the 31st of March, and that was timed really to commemorate the day 100 years ago that the ship was actually ready for sailing, although she didn't set sail until the 2nd of April. Firstly, because on the 1st of April the weather was too bad to conduct the sea trials, but those were then able to be done on the 2nd, and she was ready to leave. Well, the ship was actually just built outside the doors that we're sitting close to now. This building is placed in what would have been the heart of the shipyard, where 15,000 men would have poured in every single morning in their flat caps to get to work. And as we're looking out the east door here, you can see the original Harland & Wolff head offices and also the very famous drawing offices where the plans were all drawn up. And there's some very well-known photographs of that. So we are the only Titanic experience that can boast the fact that we are right smack in the heart of where everything was created.
I've just done the tour. Absolutely amazing exhibition. Probably one of the best I've seen. How was it conceived?
Well, the building itself was a fantastic conception, whereas the architects wanted to bring together the concept of ice, crystal, light, and I think you can see all of those things reflected in the facade of the building. Also, with the very distinctive four-hull construction of the building, each of those hulls represents one of the ages of shipbuilding, and all the materials, wood, iron, aluminium and steel, are all included in the facade of the building. Each of those hulls stands at 90 feet high, and again that ties into Titanic because that's the size of her hull, although additionally there would have been another 70 feet on the top for the funnels.
I think the amazing thing is that although the ship isn't here, you get the full experience and size of it, which was absolutely incredible.
Absolutely. The building has to be seen to be believed. When you come into the atrium, it's such a high, open, bright area, and it was designed to give the impression that, you know, you've got light on one side and then on the opposite side, and it's as if you're working between ships. That's the sense that's meant to give. And also there's lots of little lookout decks as well, which are again to give the sense of you standing on the different decks of the ship. Likewise, the different escalators going up and down were designed to replicate the kind of busy sense of the workers and those people stocking the ships as they were going up and down the gangplanks as well. So everything that's possible to think of has been included in this building, including down to details like the little wooden benches that circumvent the building actually spell out Morse code messages as well. So every conceivable detail is here.
One of the displays that really amazed me was the audiovisual, where you're going through the ship on different levels. Can you just talk us through that one?
That's affectionately known as the cave in here, and it's really a 3D experience. So you have screens on three sides of a very large square stroke rectangle, and gradually as it begins you can hear the noise of the pistons, because you begin in the engine room and that kind of rhythmic thumping starts off, and then you make a gradual ascent through all the levels of the ship with a stop off at the suite where the beautiful staircase was, and you hear the period music, the elegant period music of the time. Then you finally end up on the bridge, where you can hear the sound of the seagulls and the ringing of the bells. So it's quite mesmerising altogether. That's one feature that the guests are always bowled over by.
And what about the film show, where the submarine goes down and you actually see the Titanic as it is today?
Well, that's our Gallery 9, and Gallery 9 actually has three parts. And first of all, the entire gallery is generically known as Titanic Beneath. But that first part of it is the movie theatre, and we have an 8-minute movie that shows in great detail both parts of the wreck. It really underlines the difference in the levels of damage that occurred to the two parts of the wreck. I think most people know that she broke in half as she sank. So you're literally just floating above that, able to examine the capstans that remain, the memorial plaques that remain, and there's a very interesting running commentary with that, along with kind of hints at underwater noises. So we find that's quite relaxing for the guests after they've seen, you know, their senses are bombarded in here. So that's a nice wee sit down for them at that stage too, as well as the film being so interesting.
I think what's shocking is that ship left with all that, the luxury. I mean, you've replicated the first class cabins, and you just say, I'd love to have sailed on that ship on the first, and then the terrible devastation and destruction before it actually reached its destination.
Well, it's, you know, the one of the tragedies, of course, was the sinking and the loss of life, but I think equally as well, it was so tragic that the incredible hard work and blood, sweat and tears that would have been put into that ship over the 3-year period of skill and labour, it was such a tragedy that that never got to be seen any more than on those few days. Really, she was only about a fortnight old before she went down, and the craftsmanship that existed here in Harland and Wolff in Belfast was second to none. It was the premier shipyard in the world, and there were departments for everything, joinery, master craftsmen, even the stuffing of mattresses and upholstery. It was all done here. And to think that, you know, the efforts of 3,000 people were all in vain, I mean, that was just as much a heartbreak as the fact that the ship went down.
There was a lot of reaction in Halifax where the survivors were taken. What about the people in Belfast? What was the reaction here? The local people, the families that had worked on the ship for generations, maybe?
It's said here that for years and years it just simply wasn't spoken about. I suppose it was a mixture of the incredible sadness at such a huge loss and such a devastating blow for the shipyard. So for years here, people just did not talk about it at all.
This exhibition attracts people from all over the world. What are your opening times?
Our winter hours, we open from 10 until 5 o'clock. And then in the summer hours, which go from the beginning of April to the end of September, we open from 9 o'clock in the morning to 7 o'clock at night. So there's plenty of opportunity to come and see us here. We would love to see you. But we do advise, particularly at peak holiday times, such as bank holidays or the busy summer months, that it is advisable to check on the website and make your reservation there. And then we hate to turn people away, but obviously we have to stick to our numbers so that everybody has the best visit possible. So we would always advise to book ahead. It gives you more choice in the time that you want to choose then to come in.
So just remind me where you are situated in Belfast.
Well, we're right in the Titanic Quarter, right beside the Lagan, and that's also beside the Odyssey and W5, which are very well-known landmarks as well. But there's plenty of signage up to tell you how to find us, as well as an excellent website.
And Harland and Wolff still going strong in Belfast?
Harland and Wolff still have a very strong presence here. The last ship built was finished in 2003, but nowadays many of their efforts are concentrated in making the turbines for wind farms. So that's the main industry at the moment.
So diversifying, but still going strong.
Absolutely, and with the two landmarks of Belfast, the iconic cranes, Samson and Goliath, which dominate our skyline, painted bright yellow with H and W emblazoned upon them. And it's said that the letters on the crane are actually the size of 3 double-decker buses. So there's no doubting where you are when you see those cranes outside.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much too.
That was a feature about the Titanic exhibition in Belfast. Now to our next studio guests, Chaucer Cameron and Helen Dewberry. Their film called There Is Nothing in the Garden was a hit at the recent Cheltenham Poetry Festival. You're here to talk about a film that you've been producing for the past couple of years. I wonder if you could sort of start by telling us a little bit about it.
Yeah, we've been working on the film for a few years. The film is based on a collection of 15 poems, which work together and possibly separately. And it examines ecological disruption and personal loss, issues like that. And the film explores maternal ambivalence and trauma and loss. And that's ecologically mirrored through visual representations of earthquakes and floods and nature. The film explores ways in which the poetry and the text work together to enhance each other and to bring more narratives to the front so that you can read it in various different ways, a diversity of narratives. And hopefully it's the idea of the poems were to for transformation of loss into movement. Well, hopefully that's what it brings, a more sort of kinetic idea to the poems.
And that's presumably represented visually on the screen during the film.
Yes, yeah.
And is there a narrative string bringing all these poems together?
No, the poems are 15 separate poems, and they come from different angles on those subjects. So whilst they fit together around that general idea that Chaucer's just spoken about, they do stand alone as well as work together.
So I'm just trying to sort of visualise in my head. You've got obviously the 15 poems, as you say, and then is it different images for each poem, or is that image providing a constant undercurrent of holding everything together?
The poems have been filmed separately. So, for instance, one is based on Lundy Island, a couple in Bristol, London. I've tried to link them with the transition between the poems, so either using sound or camera work to link them together.
And these poems, are they written especially for the film?
No, the poems came out of a collection of poems that I did for my MA. I was at a university doing an MA with Gloucestershire University. And so from out of that MA, then these poems were written. And then Helen took them on and decided that perhaps it might be useful to see how they look on film and how they translate into visual images and still images and stuff.
And actually translating poems onto film is probably quite unique endeavour. It's not one that I've heard of before. What was the inspiration behind that?
There are quite a number of poetry films done in different ways, because the idea of a poetry film is to put the text of the poem, sound and visuals together to produce something else, so a sort of a third voice or different narratives. There is work that's been done around that elsewhere. The idea of these began with just an experiment. I asked Chaucer if I could have her poems that she'd done, so there were 15 of them that she gave me, and then left me really to get on with filming them. So I think that from a poet's point of view, the act of giving the poems to a filmmaker to do something else with is a big part of the process of creating, in the end, a poetry film, because the poet doesn't know what the filmmaker is going to do with them. So whilst we had some discussion along the way of me filming them, it was how I interpreted the poems and how I wanted to interpret the poems into then visual images. So the whole process was quite a... That's probably why it took a couple of years to achieve.
Some kind of negotiation between the two of you, was there?
Yes, once I'd filmed, then at some point after that, usually not immediately, I'd asked Chaucer what she thought of my ideas. Generally, there was agreement.
So, you know, when we were talking about the visual images that are in this film, was there any acting involved, or was it pictures of everyday life? You know, you mentioned that you filmed in Bristol and in London and on Lundy Island. Was it to go and film ambience things that are happening, or was there, did you actually get actors involved?
For one poem, we actually stood outside the Arnolfini in Bristol and asked people to describe Kokeshi doll, because the poem was about the making of Kokeshi dolls. We got voices of about 12 different people describing the doll, put those together, and interestingly, that created a poem in itself. And then we asked the same people to read a verse of the poem and put it together in that way. So we used different people for that one. Otherwise, sometimes there was a voiceover reading the poem, and at other times there was the words on the screen rather than the voiceover.
So it's a really sort of mixture of both audio and visual then.
Yeah, and some of it was abstract and some of it was more concrete. People going about their daily business.
So we used a lot of different genres, really.
Absolutely.
Which was quite interesting in its process. Putting those words on the screen, the process was interesting because we had to make, or Helen had to make, certain decisions as to whether such and such a poem would be enhanced by the words on the screen or off the screen or voiceovers or all different ones. We took the decision on each one, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I thought it'd be quite interesting. How much difference is the impact of a poem in film than a poem from the traditional way of reading it, in a book or on paper?
We've had lots of discussions about that and whether some poems don't lend themselves to being filmed, and try to analyse which poems or what type of poem might be enhanced and come up with different narratives by filming. It's fairly experimental.
There are a number of theoretical film poetry, theoretical debates anyway, from, university levels generally, that come out with the ideas of which films are enhanced and which films aren't, and what works and what doesn't, what detracts from the image and what doesn't. And you really learn that by just going, doing it. You learn that.
Thanks, Dave, to Choss Cameron and Helen Dewberry. Malcolm Grieve reads another short story.
From The Illustrated Man by Ray Bradbury, a collection of weird and wonderful tales. Tales that were tattooed onto the body of a man by a witch. The Highway. The cooling afternoon rain had come over the valley, touching the corn in the tilled mountain fields, tapping on the dry grass roof of the hut. In the rainy darkness, the woman ground corn between cakes of lava rock, working steadily. In the wet lightlessness, somewhere, a baby cried. Hernando stood waiting for the rain to cease so he might take the wooden plough into the field again. Below, the river broiled brown and thickened in its course. The concrete highway, another river, did not flow at all. It lay shining, empty. A car had not come along it in an hour. This was, in itself, of unusual interest. Over the years, there had not been an hour when a car had not pulled up, someone shouting, "Hey there, can we take your picture?" Someone with a box that clicked and a coin in his hand. If he walked slowly across the field without his hat, sometimes they called, "Oh, we want you with your hat on." And they waved their hands, rich with gold things that told time, or identified them, or did nothing at all but wink like spiders' eyes in the sun. So he would turn and go back to get his hat. His wife spoke. "Something is wrong, Hernando." "See, the road. Something big has happened. Something big to make the road so empty this way." He walked from the hut, slowly and easily, the rain washing over the twined shoes of grass and thick tire rubber he wore. He remembered very well the incident of this pair of shoes. The tire had come into the hut with violence one night, exploding the chickens and the pots apart. It had come alone, rolling swiftly. The car off which it had come had rushed on as far as the curve and hung a moment, headlights reflected, before plunging into the river. The car was still there. One might see it on a good day, when the river ran slow and the mud cleared. Deep under, its metal shining, long and low and very rich, lay the car. But then the mud came in again, and you saw nothing. The following day he had carved the shoe soles from the tire rubber. He reached the highway now, and stood upon it, listening to the small sounds it made in the rain. Then suddenly, as if at a signal, the cars came. Hundreds of them, miles of them, rushing and rushing as he stood by and by him. The big, long black cars heading north towards the United States, roaring, taking the curves at too great a speed, with a ceaseless blowing and honking. And there was something about the faces of the people packed into the cars, something which dropped him into a deep silence. He stood back and let the cars roar on. He counted them until he tired. 500, 1,000 cars passed, and there was something in the faces of all of them, but they moved too swiftly for him to tell what this thing was. Finally the silence and emptiness returned. The swift, long, low convertible cars were gone. He heard the last horn fade. The road was empty again. It had been like a funeral cortege, but a wild one, racing hair out, screaming to some ceremony ever northward. Why? He could only shake his head and rub his fingers softly at his sides. Now, all alone, a final car, there was something very, very final about it. Down the mountain road, in the thin, cool air, fuming up great clouds of steam, came an old Ford. It was travelling as swiftly as it might. He expected it to break apart at any instant. When this ancient Ford saw Hernando, it pulled up, caked with mud and rusted, the radiator bubbling angrily. "May we have some water, please, Signor?" A young man, perhaps 21, was driving. He wore a yellow sweater, an open-collared white shirt and grey pants. In the topless car the rain fell upon him, and 5 young women packed so they could not move in the interior. They were all very pretty, and they were keeping the rain from themselves and the driver with old newspapers. But the rain got through to them, soaking their bright dresses, soaking the young man. His hair was plastered with rain. But they did not seem to care. None complained, and this was unusual. Always before they complained of rain, of heat, of time, of cold, of distance. Hernando nodded. "I'll bring you water." "Oh, please, hurry," one of the girls cried. She sounded very high and afraid. There was no impatience in her, only an asking out of fear. For the first time Hernando ran when a tourist asked. Always before he had walked slower at such requests. He returned with a hub lid full of water. This, too, had been a gift from the highway. One afternoon it had sailed like a flung coin into his field, round and glittering. The car to which it belonged had slid on, oblivious to the fact that it had lost silver eye. Until now, he and his wife had used it for washing and cooking. It made a fine bowl. As he poured the water into the boiling radiator, Hernando looked up at their stricken faces. "Oh, thank you," said one of the girls. "You don't know what this means." Hernando smiled. "So much traffic in this hour. It all goes one way, north." He did not mean to say anything to hurt them. But when he looked up again, there all of them sat in the rain, and they were crying. They were crying very hard, and the young man was trying to stop them by laying his hands on their shoulders and shaking them gently, one at a time. But they held their papers over their heads, and their mouths moved, and their eyes were shut, and their faces changed colour, and they cried, some aloud, some soft. Hernando stood with a half-empty lid in his fingers. "I did not mean to say anything, Signor," he apologised.
"That's all right," said the driver.
"What is wrong, Signor?" "Haven't you heard?" replied the young man, turning, holding tightly to the wheel with one hand, leaning forward. "It's happened." This was bad. The others at this cried still harder, holding on to each other, forgetting their newspapers, letting the rain fall and mingle with their tears. Hernando stiffened. He put the rest of the water into the radiator. He looked at the sky, which was black with storm. He looked at the river rushing. He felt the asphalt under his shoes. He came to the side of the car. The young man took his hand and gave him a peso. "No." Hernando gave it back. "It is my pleasure."
"Thank you. You're so kind," said one of the girls, still sobbing. "Oh, Mama, Papa, oh, I want to be home, I want to be home."
And others held her. "I did not hear, Signor," said Hernando quietly.
The war! Shouted the young man as if no one could hear. It's come! The Atom War! The end of the world! Señor, señor, said Hernando. Thank you. Thank you for your help. Goodbye, said the young man. Goodbye, they all said in the rain, not seeing him. He stood while the car engaged its gears and rattled off down, fading away through the valley. Finally it was gone, and the young women in it, the last car, the newspapers held fluttered over their heads. Hernando did not move for a long time. The rain ran very cold down his cheeks and along his fingers and into the woven garment on his legs. He held his breath, waiting, tight and tensed. He watched the highway, but it did not move again. He doubted that it would move much for a very long time. The rain stopped. The sky broke through the clouds. In 10 minutes, the storm was gone like a bad breath. A sweet wind blew the smell of the jungle up to him. He could hear the river moving gently and easily on its way. The jungle was very green. Everything was fresh. He walked down through the field to his house and picked up his plough. With his hands on it, he looked at the sky beginning to burn hot with the sun. His wife called out from her work, "What happened, Fernando?" "It is nothing," he replied. He set the plough in the furrow. He called sharply to his burro, "Burro!" And they walked together through the rich field, under the clearing sky, on their tilled land by the deep river. "What do they mean?" "The world," he said.
That's all from Backchat this week. Studio engineer was Adrian Pietrowski and the producer was Anthea Page.
So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Paul.
It's goodbye from me, James Melia.
And goodbye from me, Poppy Searchfield.
So until next week, goodbye.